Naylor's Natter the Book, ideas and advice from the collective wisdom of teachers. Naylor's Natter brings together a wealth of advice from the most influential voices in education today. In this exciting, one-of-a-kind book, Phil Naylor revisits the very best interviews from 3 years of education podcasting, drawing on the advice and opinions from some of the world's most innovative educators. Available now for pre-order from Amazon and out on July 7th, 2022.
Naylor's Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Naylor's Natter, just talking to teachers.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to the latest edition of Naylor's Natter. Now, I'm delighted to welcome back Amy Forrester for her hat trick of appearances. So, welcome back, Amy.
Thank you. It's really nice to be here.
And we were just chatting off air, Amy, weren't we, saying that we did the first one, and Amy was really good to me, listeners, in the very early days of Naylor's Natter, that she came on, and you can still find it on there in the very early episodes, sort of like episode 3 or 4, maybe very early days. And then we did one this time last year, or slightly before this time last year, and we agreed to kind of pause on it because we were in a very much state of flux and we were doing stuff around remote learning or in schools. We paused, and it's still in the archive. So you never know, listener. You might get a bonus bit of Amy on this. You might get episodes 2 and 3 coming out as a double whammy. So we don't need to do the gentle introduction, principally because you've obviously been on once officially, twice completely. But what we can do is, what have you been up to since last time we spoke? And perhaps you can give us a little bit about your book, which is going to be the focus of our discussion tonight.
Yeah, so that everyone's had various lockdown projects going on, haven't they? And I think that was mine. So I wanted to write something that really filled what I can see as a gap in the market in terms of, like, for pastoral leaders. So I wanted to kind of take all the practical on the job kind of stuff, but also, like, a lot of the research and the academic focus and the other things that you might read and develop and learn about that takes a really long time in pastoral care to learn all of that. I wanted to kind of capture that. And kind of give people, probably mostly for those who are starting out, but also those that are experienced as well, that want to find out some other, like, new bits of information, somewhere to go for that. Because at the moment, I don't feel like, especially when being a head of year and a pastoral leader, that there was anything that really did that. So that's what I've been up to, diligently writing away.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that you did. And I've been very fortunate, listener, to have sight of this book prior to release. So Amy was very kind to send it across. And I know what that's like, sending it out into the world. I've been doing it this week, Amy, as well. I've sent mine out to people to have a little look at. So, you know, I was just blown away by it. I thought, this is exactly what we need. So, I mean, we have spoken to people on the podcast before about pastoral care and, you know, but this is a really practical guide that kind of marries up evidence and research, like you said, but with that kind of wisdom that previous to these kind of books coming out, you could only gain from years and years in the trenches actually doing the job. And, you know, if you're somebody who's just new to pastoral care, what a time to start in 2022, because there's a lot of it. So this book could give you a really good starting point to kind of formulate your ideas before you, you know, before you get set about the challenges of pastoral care. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Right, so let's get into the questions. And the first one is going to be, so the title of the book is Pastoral Leadership, but what does pastoral care mean to you?
For me, it's about creating a school where every child is able to thrive. And that looks different in different schools with different cohorts, different contexts, different challenges. But it also looks different for each individual student, and their needs and their what they need in terms of being around them can change throughout their time at school. And it's about creating a school that really focuses on that and gives every child what they need. But ultimately, and this is something I touch on in the book quite a lot, that sometimes I think can run the risk of getting lost in pastoral care. Kids come to school to learn and to achieve and to thrive, and ultimately to leave school with GCSE results, A-level results that open doors and change lives. And that's the end product of pastoral care. We are responsible for creating the conditions where they can do that. And it's keeping that in mind, really. You've got your safeguarding and all that kind of things, but it's more about creating the conditions for them to thrive. And that's what pastoral care for me is all about.
Absolutely. And I think that, in the research for my book, Plugs On Book Again and On Podcast, but so somebody's got to him. But I did some bits of looking into sort of pastoral leadership and the fact that, you know, it's kind of withered away in recent years and been seen as something that's not essential and maybe even, you know, is taking time away from that valuable curriculum time. And I think it was Michael Wilshaw, well, I know it was because I did the research, who talked about, you know, utilizing all the available time for learning. So something like form time, for example, became, you know, something where there had to be some kind of objective and learning. Not that there shouldn't be pastorally, but it's been nice to see sort of prior to the pandemic and certainly, you know, during and the continuing situation now, that pastoral leadership has become a focus again for schools. Lots of schools anecdotally are bringing back heads of year. I know that's something that you do. And also bringing back, you know, roles that perhaps had been moved away because of that focus, completely rightly, on curriculum and teaching and learning.
Yeah, and I think the bit that probably gets lost there is all that work on teaching and learning and curriculum can't have the desired impact unless you're looking after your kids ultimately. I totally get that argument about not wasting time. And again, it's something I touch on in the book, is making sure you use all of your pastoral time wisely, because that's what you've got to prove. You've got that time. You need to use it for something that's going to help young people and that isn't a waste of their time. If it's wasting their time, you might as well not have that time, because it, you know, that's time that's out the window when kids only get one shot at school and at an education. That really matters to me.
Yeah, definitely. So we talked about that this book can be for everybody. And, you know, I got some, as someone who's done, you know, pastoral care on and off for 21 years. I know that those of you that are watching this will find that hard to believe. You know, you'll think it's been about 41 years based on how I look on a Monday night after the first day back after half term. But it's also useful for new people into the position as well, which you've talked about. So how can these pastoral leaders, you know, often the ones with, as you write in the book, with little experience in the field, ensure that they have high standards and high expectations of their year group, tutor group, whatever it might be?
I think it's one of those things that sounds really simple, because you never meet a teacher or somebody who works in a school in a non-teaching role that would say, I've got low expectations of kids. And yet we all know that there are some staff that have lower expectations of kids than others. And one of the most important things you can do as a new pastoral leader is to make sure that you benchmark yourself and to make sure that if what you're calling high standards, are they actually high standards? Now, that might look at, you know, looking at other schools, visiting other schools, seeing what's possible. It's also about knowing your cohort and what high expectations looks like in your school for your kids. And it's also about the whole school approach, because a good school will have that as part of its vision and all staff will be on board with that. But sometimes you might find yourself working in a school that isn't that way or that hasn't quite got the standards set yet. And in that case, it's really up to you to really drive that forward and make sure that what you're doing actually is achieving those best standards that are possible.
Nailers, Natter, just talking to teachers.
Yeah, and I think that is something we've got to be really alert to as pastoral leaders. And it's something I remind myself of every single day. There's things I will come across every single day in school where I have to remind myself of that and of the fact that we do need to push every child to achieve the best that they can do. And that it is an unkindness to lower the standards. And it does ultimately feel like something that we think when we are maybe being too harsh or we're being unkind. But whenever you feel like that, you need to remind yourself that it's the opposite. And that actually lowering your standards is one of the most unkind things that you can do to a child, because you're ultimately saying, I don't think you're capable of doing what everyone else can do. And that is the worst message that we could ever give to a young person, because if we don't believe in them, who else is going to?
Completely. And I mean, obviously, you know, I can hear people shouting at the podcast and saying, well, you know, reasonable adjustments, reasonable expectations, you know, taking into account, you know, send or taking into account other, you know, experiences. That's obviously, that is something that, that pastoral leaders are experts in, and they're best placed, because we will be aware of all of those issues and we'll be able to take into consideration that. But actually, when we think about, you know, not having those high expectations and those high standards, you know, if we don't do that as a year group leader or as an assistant head in charge of behaviour or as a deputy head in charge of, you know, personal development, welfare, whatever it might be, that's actually, it's detrimental to the most vulnerable students when you don't provide those high standards, when you don't provide those high expectations, because they're the ones that are most likely to suffer from that. So actually, people who are saying make reasonable adjustments for that are right, but if you're not, you know, having those high expectations and those high standards, it's probably the most vulnerable students who are going to suffer in the long term.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a risk that things like reasonable adjustments become synonymous for lowering expectations. And that isn't the case. That isn't what reasonable adjustments and things like that are about. It's about making adjustments so that they can do what everyone else can do and that they can be held to the same standards, but in a way that is supportive of whatever it is that you need to be adjusting reasonably for.
Completely. Well, that leads us nicely into the next question. And I'm just reading my questions, Amy, and I need to mark myself down on the quality of my questions, because I've said, is behaviour inseparable from behaviour? And it wasn't some kind of philosophical question that I was trying to drive at there. I was trying to say, is behaviour inseparable from pastoral care?
I don't think you can separate the two things. I think they are so tightly interlinked that you're in no position to separate out the two, because pastoral care informs everything in a school. So if you're managing a child's behaviour, or you're finding some ways to support them, or you're dealing with like a high level incident, a serious incident, that has to be informed by that pastoral understanding of a child. And there's lots of people who will say things like, well, all behaviour is a communication. The pastoral need behind that, even if I disagree with that somewhat, it's informed by that child's circumstances, their context, what's going on in their lives. And not using that as an excuse is important. But you have to be informed by that, because a child's life and circumstances may mean that you have to deal with behaviour in one way, or you make slight adaptations, or, you know, you do whatever's right for that child. But you can't separate out those two things, because they're one and the same to me.
No, completely. And something that you talk about in the chapter, for people who are maybe new to the role, or people that are, you know, perhaps new to an SLT role within pastoral leadership, is about the importance of systems. And you talk about in the chapter about, you know, the lack of a system for leadership of behaviour has an impact across the board, both in terms of, you know, academic progress, but also in terms of, you know, the pastoral aspect. Because a system that without a system, it can become chaotic, can't it, in school?
Absolutely.
And that's where you'll see then a spike in the number of pastoral behaviour-related incidents that you've got to kind of work on. So in terms of, you know, setting up a system, or the importance of systems, just talk to us a little bit about what the role of pastoral leadership is in that.
So for me, I had a really interesting role in my school. For a couple of years, my job was pastoral lead for Key Stage 4, sort of like a hybrid of like partly an SLT role, partly a middle leader role. And it was also about behaviour and moving our school from not having really any systems at all through to implementing something that we really needed. And that gave me the opportunity to see how those two things work together, because as a pastoral leader, you're the person on the front line of any behaviour system. You might not be implementing it all the time, because that's often the role of a classroom teacher, but you are the person that is the face of that. So, you know, say a child gets a warning or whatever your system is in class, and they come to you and they go, oh, you'll never guess what, this has happened, that's happened, it's so unfair, blah, 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 blah. I want it taken off. The minute you are weak and you go, oh, yeah, that sounds like you've been really hard done by there, I'll take it off for you, you've broken the system. You've weakened the chain. And that is so important when it comes to systems and to pastoral care, because like it or not, you are the face of the school for the kids in your year group, but also for parents. And you, any pastoral leader will know a lot of your time will be taken up with parents, sometimes complaining about things like that, or complaining about something that's happened to their child, they've had a detention, whatever it is. Your role is in consistently enforcing that in your school, and making sure that it's done properly, and that you play that role in holding the line, really. And it's about taking professional pride, and that sometimes that means some really difficult conversations and some really difficult conversations with parents or with students. But ultimately, as a middle leader, your role is about creating a school that teachers can teach in, so that your kids can learn, so that they can go on to do really well. So you've got to make sure that your role in that is to support staff as well as to support in young people when it comes to behaviour systems.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm just going to read your own work to you, Amy, but this is a bit that I highlighted because I thought this is really important and really true. So a pastoral leader must at all times support classroom teachers in their use of a behaviour system. The most important thing for a pastoral leader is to never, ever undermine a classroom teacher, even when you feel that they might have misjudged something.
Naylor's Natter, just talking to teachers.
Yeah, it is. And I think there's a lot of schools as well that have non-teaching pastoral roles for heads of year. And this book is also for them, because I think that bit for non-teaching pastoral leaders is probably, it's going to take longer for you to understand that if you haven't got the classroom experience, because as a classroom teacher, you know, you need heads a year to have your back. And if you get it wrong, you get it wrong, and you'll have that conversation in private. But publicly, the role is about supporting staff and creating those conditions where kids can be excellent.
Absolutely. And, you know, bangs on about own hobby horse again that he talks about, but I've finally gone back in the classroom, Amy, and I was laughing with Emma, who's our assistant head in charge of teaching and learning today. We meet regularly. I was laughing with her because she listens to the podcast. Goodness knows why, when she has to work with me. I mean, why would you? But she does. And she said, oh, you're on about teaching one lesson a day again, or three lessons a week, or whatever it is. But the importance of mentioning it in this context is you've got a very different view. I know what you're talking about there in terms of, you know, non-teaching heads of year have a different view, but also, you know, non-teaching or, you know, teaching less SLT will have a different view. When you're on call constantly picking up students on call, compared to when you have to exist within your own behaviour system. And you do see that much more from the teacher's point of view when you're actively in the classroom living it. Because, you know, you can't, you know, put your superhero cape on and go, you can't misbehave for the deputy head. How dare you? I'm going to do this, that, and the other. You have to exist within your own behaviour system, and you do understand and empathise much more with staff in terms of what it's like on a day-to-day basis, but also about making sure that you're not one of these. I saw it on Twitter the other day that says, you know, right, I'm going to go and put these students back into the classroom, even though they've been removed. You know, you would avoid doing anything like that completely if you're in the classroom yourself and understand what it's like.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, for me, that's unforgivable. If you, you know, if someone who is more senior, whether that's a head of year or SLT, undermines a teacher in that way, that means ultimately that your system is broken, and that isn't putting the kids first. It's just avoiding difficult conversations, and we just don't need that in a school.
Mm. No, it's really important. And I often trot out the Sam Strickland. I think he's the only person who's been on the podcast more than you. And he's been on four times, I think, Sam Strickland now. If he comes on again, he can run it. But, you know, I often use his phrase of, you know, and people get sick of me saying it, you know, if I let you off, I'll let you down.
Yeah.
And We you know, we've got new guidance around how to use mobile phones. And, you know, there's been times when, you know, I was just checking the time, or I was just, you know, I was doing this. No, if I let you off, let you down. And it's really important for staff to see that, that you're consistently applying it. And actually, again, you know, we go back to what we said before. They actually, in my experience, seem to prefer the strict boundaries, the high expectations, the clear expectations, and actually thrive better in that. We've had nothing but praise from the student panels. They are delighted that they can now play football, or they can speak to each other, or they can not have to be intruded on by endless Snapchat groups or WhatsApp groups saying things that they don't want to hear. So actually, you know, sometimes we think we're helping, but maybe we're not. And these high expectations and routines and systems are actually beneficial.
Yeah, they absolutely are.
Let's get into back into the book. So you've talked about the use of student behaviour plans. Now, I've latched onto this because I really like this, Amy, and I think this is one thing that I'm going to take away straight away and try and use, because we've done the old-fashioned report cards. We've looked at, you know, monitoring that and ticking off targets. But your student behaviour plans are a little bit different, aren't they? A little bit more detailed. So just tell us about those and how you recommend they should be used.
Yeah, so I think when it comes to dealing with individuals, sometimes you need an individual approach. And when you think about it from a classroom teacher, say, I don't know, you're an IT teacher, you teach 400 kids a week, and you're expected to remember the minute intricacies of kids that have higher level needs than others. That can be really difficult. And creating something like a student behaviour plan can really make it clear what's happening with that child. It helps staff to do the right thing. And often that isn't because they don't want to, but it's the sheer overload of a full-time teaching role and a teaching timetable. You need to know what the plan is with each child and be able to refer back to it and make sure that you're doing the right thing by that child. But it also keeps things really clear for everyone. So the child knows what's happening. Teaching staff know what's happening. You know what's happening. Parents know what's happening. And that way you're a far more united front for that child and doing what they need. It's not something that you would have loads of kids on, because the vast majority of kids will tick along just fine. But when you need something a little bit more bespoke, I think having things like that, like you say, that it's moving it on from the, you know, the being on report and that kind of thing to something that is a little bit more, this is how you need to deal with this child in your classroom. And that isn't changing the expectations. It's about how you help that child to meet them in a way that works for whatever their needs are at that time.
Yeah, and that's really important. I mean, we've done something similar with kind of a one-page profile for students that have, you know, hit a particular trigger maybe on a behaviour system, or have been within a different provision for a period of time. And it's a good way of kind of phasing them back in, like you said, of meeting the students where they are, but not kind of, you know, making adjustments that would mean they don't have to follow certain rules, for example. So I think if listeners are, obviously listeners will be going out to get the book straight away, but that's a really practical strategy that you can use for those students. That's really, really good. Right, Amy, this next bit, this is the key bit of the book, and this is why the book is indispensable in my view for the pastoral leader, because we've seen, you know, we've seen sort of education move into an evidence and research based profession, even though Dylan Williams said that it wouldn't be. But, you know, it's moving in that kind of direction where we're more based around evidence and research. But pastoral has always been kind of seen as an area that you're either good at or you're not. You're either steeped in or you aren't. You're either, you know, you've got it or you haven't, that sort of approach to it. But actually, you've distilled the best of, you know, cognitive science or evidence and research and kind of tied that in with practical strategies for listeners. So just talk to us a little bit about how research and evidence has impacted pastoral care. And, you know, can you suggest any practical strategies for the listener based on that?
I think part of it is about being up to date with the research and evidence that's happening in terms of teaching and learning, because a lot of that is really highly transferable to pastoral care. One of the things I talk about in the book is about things like, you know, your cognitive science, your forgetting curve, your retrieval practice, that sort of thing. Your teaching staff will know that and they'll be using that, but you kind of have to transfer that into pastoral care as well, because you're missing part of the picture if you don't. And so an example to sort of talk maybe about the practical strategies is making sure that you have a succinct plan in your school where from a pastoral point of view, you're teaching children about those concepts and about learning and about why that matters, because that's all part of pastoral care. So they want to learn and they want to succeed. They've got exams to do. They're going to be stressful. Your role as a pastoral leader is making that path as smooth as possible. And it's how you use that research and that evidence as another weapon in the arsenal for doing that, really. So, you know, if you're teaching kids throughout from year 7 to 11 about how we learn, about how the brain works, about how to create long-term learning and long-term memories, then that leads to more confident learners. That leads them to be more successful. That leads them to do better. It leads them to be less stressed. So the knock-on impact on pastoral care is huge. And so taking those bits of research and evidence in that sense is really important. And then there's other areas as well, like in the attendance chapter, I've touched on what I think is one of the most important documents that's from the US that really looks at attendance. And I know they call it dropout in the USA, but it's, you know, it's, the concept is similar. And the work that's going on in more niche areas like that also needs to be factored in. So you've got obviously your pedagogical research and evidence, but there are other aspects to pastoral care that also have it. And sometimes it's really hard to find it or to know what you're looking for, which is why I've tried to cover what I think the main things are currently for pastoral leaders in the book.
I think it's absolutely brilliant. I mean, I've got the chapter here in front of me, and I just think that, you know, some of the stuff we've tried to do, some of the stuff, but kind of without knowingly going back to the cognitive science or the research and actually thinking about it. So a good example maybe that we've tried to do is around the importance of highlighting reporting procedures for safeguarding for staff, for example, and the need for students to know how to report safeguarding concerns. So Sarah Chesterny, who leads on the personal development and welfare at our school, always has a slide on the end of every assembly around, here is the safeguarding team. Now, when you've put this in, it's around that forgetting curve, isn't it? Or yeah. It's around, you know, Rosenshine's principles of instruction. You know, you've got some new information, but you're kind of revisiting prior learning before you're going into that. And people, you know, teachers, and myself included, have never really joined the dots there with pastoral care and thought it's equally as important to teach behaviour, to teach personal development, welfare, safeguarding, as it is a curriculum, as it is, you know, to teach other curriculum subjects. I mean, you know, think about behavior. You know, I had that conversation with Paul Dix and Tom Bennett around the importance of teaching behavior. You know, you can do that in your classroom around the principles of cognitive science, can't you? So I think that's absolutely a really, really interesting topic, that, and that's something that other people haven't really looked at, have they?
No, and it's that gap between the teaching and learning and the traditionally like academic side of things and the pastoral. It's been massively overlooked for various different reasons, I think, but the link is all there. We just need to join the dots a little bit more effectively in schools, I think.
Like, I loved the reference to nudge theory. I mean, if you think that, yeah. You know, we spend a lot of time with that, just constantly going over and over the same thing, and just, you know, we got marginal gains around, right, routines, systems, structures, revisiting, constantly kind of pushing that message out there all the time. But again, I love the way that you've linked that to pastoral care, which, you know, has been seen as sort of more alchemy, hasn't it, than evidence previously.
Yeah, it has. And I think that's one of the things that probably blows my mind the most about pastoral leadership, is that we just expect people to be just born good at it. And I know that's part of, you know, that we see that sometimes in leadership in general. But there's all this kind of stuff that you should really know. And there's a chapter about leadership more general, and where I talk about the importance of domain-specific knowledge. This is that's kind of what the book is about. It's about going, here's a fairly comprehensive level of domain-specific knowledge that you can base your leadership off. And then when you start to do that, you see the other connections. So you see, right, well, if I'm using nudge theory to try and improve attendance, how are we using something like nudge theory with staff development? are we training staff on one thing and then never talking to them about it again for the rest of that academic year, but still expecting them to do it? Knowing, you know, we stand in front of kids, we talk about, you know, the forgetting curve, we talk about how we will forget things, we forget staff will forget things, and they're so busy and they're so overloaded, and we kind of need to link all of that up as well.
Definitely. And for the listener, that chapter is a real go-to in terms of kind of joining up those dots. I find that really interesting, and that's, I've got lots of highlighted on my copy down here, Amy, definitely.
Talking to teachers about educational books, why we love them and how we use them in our classrooms. With guest authors, publishers, podcasters, and of course, teachers.
Right, you've mentioned attendance. Now, obviously, it's been a difficult time, hasn't it, for attendance? Because you know, schools will have differing pictures with this, won't they? Because of, you know, X codes and goodness knows what else for, you know, so it's not really been a reflection. But as we now record this on the day when the Prime Minister, I'm not allowed to show political bias according to the Education Secretary, so I must keep it just, you know. But the Prime Minister has announced the end to the need to self-isolate. So we should see, in theory, an increase in attendance. But why is attendance one of the most frustrating aspects of pastoral care, and what practical strategies do you suggest that readers can take to kind of address that?
I think for me, it's the most frustrating because there are no easy answers. Something like attendance is, there's a whole host of things going on beneath the surface, from your kind of community values to individual families to individual students, and every barrier is different, and it's never something I feel like I could ever imagine, where you get to a point where you go, yeah, attendance is fine. You know, you can have good attendance in your school, but there will still be kids that aren't attending as regularly as they could be. And that's probably why I think it's the most frustrating thing, because you just want kids in school every day. And it sounds really simple, just get kids into school. But actually, it's really, really difficult. And the one thing I really worry about in terms of the after effects of the pandemic is just the knock-on impact that that's had on attendance. And, you know, yes, part of it is about, you know, they've had to isolate and whatnot, but it runs far deeper than that, because the message that they've had for the past two academic years is that full-time attendance at school isn't as important as some other things. And parents have seen them work at home, and they've seen them, you know, be all right or not all right in that case. And I think that has really weakened the perception and the value of attendance at school. I don't know about you, but we've had a real increase in people saying, oh, they're not well today, can you just set some work online? Like, no, because they're missing the teaching, like that teaching part, that expert, subject expert, stood in a classroom, teaching you their subject is the most powerful part of your school experience. And we can't replicate that with a worksheet on the internet. Like, it just doesn't translate. And it helping students and parents to understand that is really difficult. And it, you know, you talk about what the Prime Minister's sort of announced today. And part of me, I'll be honest, and I might get some pushback for this, but part of me went, okay, well, at least we can get attendance back on the right, you know, on an even keel, because we're able now to have kids in school more often. And that, there's lots of different feelings that people might have about this, and I'm certainly saying this isn't the only feeling to have, but from that point of view, with my attendance hat on, I'm thinking, okay, well, that's actually quite helpful. And it helps us get back into a better position with it. In terms of practical strategies, it's one of those where you kind of have to throw the kitchen sink at it. And I don't normally advocate that for most problems that you find in schools, but attendance is one of them. And the Ofsted report that I've talked about in the book from a couple of years ago now talks about the schools that have the best approaches with attendance are those that have that absolute bullish determination that they will have every kid in school every day, and that they will find every barrier and they will beat it down and they will get those kids into school. But it is, honestly, it is persistent. It is draining. It takes a real level of tenacity and persistence to tackle some really kind of systemic attendance issues. And I'm not talking about the, you know, the vast majority of kids that go to school when they're as often as they're meant to go to school. But the more you kind of creep down the attendance levels, like you look at like 90 to 95, you look at 90 to 85, you look at 80 and below, you know, the harder that becomes to help, because it means that there are much more complex issues beneath the surface. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's about health systems and about physical needs or medical needs. And the state of local services it just doesn't help in that sense either. And there's so much is fundamentally broken that it makes it a really, really tricky area to get where you want to be.
Mm. But in terms of what you've put in the book, and I couldn't agree more with the start of it. So you talked about that, you know, like safeguarding is everybody's business. You've got to make attendance everybody's business.
Absolutely.
So everybody has to buy into the idea that they have a responsibility for the attendance of their form group. So if you're a form teacher, most people are, for, you know, heads of year, I've got that as a standing agenda item. We have a weekly meeting around attendance. So Monday morning briefing for heads of year is purely on attendance. Just yeah. to have that kind of whole school approach on it. You know, like you've suggested in the book, we have, you know, first day calls, we've got home visits. I mean, we've brought in an external service to do a PWO role. So we have, you know, a pupil welfare officer that, along with our pastoral leads, we conduct home visits on a second or third day absence.
Yeah.
Just to see whether, like you said, is there an issue? You know, can we support with that? And again, you know, working in disadvantaged areas, we have, you know, links to, you know, family support workers, whatever it might be, who can tie in and see what the issue is that they can then bring them back in. But you're absolutely right in terms of your strategies about it being, you know, a leadership responsibility. It's everyone's responsibility. And they're relentless because, you know, Andrew Perman, you know, High Noon as he is on Twitter, but he thinks he can be High Noon. I'm saying this for his benefit and Hyde. We all know who he is. We all know who he is. But he's our deputy in charge of behaviour and attendance. And he would echo a lot of what you're saying in the book. You know, it's been 3-4 years of him, a constant war of attrition on this in terms of daily focus on attendance. And I liked what else you said, Amy, and I thought this is really good and really true. You know, when you notice someone who's not been in for a while, in your class, in your form group, in your year group, whatever it might be, or even us as senior leaders, and say, oh, nice to see you. You know, how are you? You feeling all right? And it does make a big difference that they're being noticed for being in.
Yeah, I learned that lesson off one of the best people I've ever worked with, who I talk about in the book. Is I know I've embarrassed him, but Ian Routledge was the person who taught me that when I sort of first started out. He was like, the power of noticing is a huge part of attendance. Not for those kids necessarily where you've got lots of other things in place, but those kids that are just tinkering towards their attendance becoming an issue. If they know somebody at school notices that they're absent, they're more likely to come in because they feel valued and they feel like somebody cares about them. And equally noticing and somebody saying to that child, was everything all right? Is there anything we can help with? Are you behind on anything? And making sure that there's this kind of system that catches those really powerful conversations. I think that's just so important, and it's so simple. And when Ian was working on it, when he was looking after attendance, it just sort of, I was like, yeah, it's simple, but it's powerful.
Mm. And again, you know, I like what you've done with, you talk about rewards and incentives, and, you know, I'm not saying it's a mistake for a new pastoral leader to try and reward the way through, you know, behavior or attendance, and saying, right, well, let's find the most challenging students in school and reward them for the very basic of expectations for a week. And that might improve their behavior slightly, but it might skew the other 75% who wonder why on earth they don't get that. And the same for attendance. I'm not saying it's a mistake to reward attendance, and you're not saying that in the book, but you're saying, you know, again, this is that kind of sage advice that you built up over time, that consider that carefully, what the knock-on effect of that will be. You know, will they stop attending if the reward is not there? What about the people who attend every single day? And as the parent of a child who, you know, has had 100% attendance for a few years, even during this, you know, it does annoy you at the end of the year, and this is for primary colleagues, you know, when you go to the end of year celebration and the child who's managed to get 60% attendance gets, you know, most improved student, and you think, well, hang on a minute, zero behaviour points and 100% attendance, and she sat there with nothing. Again, it's more nuanced than that, but at least you've put it on the radar of people reading the book to think about it. Because we've all fallen into that trap of thinking we can reward our way out of bad behaviour or bad attendance, and it's not as easy as that.
No, it's not. And I think I always think back to, and it's normally kids that I remember specifically when I think back to this, like kids with, you know, physical health needs or disabilities or, you know, real issues that mean that they, for whatever reason, can't attend as much as they'd like to. But if they're sat next to somebody, if they're in school every single day, as much as they can be with the barriers that they've got, and they sit next to somebody else who is getting praise for something that isn't as much of an achievement as that, or they don't get their 100% attendance award because they had an appointment with the consultant over in Newcastle, and that takes a day when you live in Cumbria.
Yeah.
But that's just the most devastating message that we can send to them. We're saying the things outside of your control mean we're not recognising your achievements. And it's that you've got to think about attendance and pastoral care and rewards and stuff like that with that lens on of, like, how would it affect this child? How does it affect that child? And for me, it's individual children that I think of when I'm running sense checks on things like this. I go, right, well, what about this child that I know? How would that affect them? Would they be getting the right message? I think it's really important, and it's easily overlooked in the busy humdrum of school life.
Yeah, it is. And again, you've saved people the need for trial and error. just buy the book, read the book, and it will put you in a position where you'll be 6-7 years further on than I was when I started to learn some of these things by painful experience. Right, and another thing, Amy, about kind of painful experiences, the pastoral leader, where you maybe compare and contrast with either a phase leader in primary or a, you know, a curriculum leader perhaps in secondary, they do quite often exist as a lone wolf solving everybody's problems, students, staff, everybody else. And yeah. I don't know whether you have a radio system. I think a lot of schools do have a radio system. And the names you hear on the radio quite often are the same names shouted repeatedly to solve all problems. So the question I'm coming round to is, how important is leadership in pastoral care? But how vital is it that leaders sort of motivate, lead and manage a team rather than looking to solve all problems himself?
Naylor's Natter the Book, ideas and advice from the collective wisdom of teachers. Naylor's Natter brings together a wealth of advice from the most influential voices in education today. In this exciting, one-of-a-kind book, Phil Naylor revisits the very best interviews from 3 years of education podcasting, drawing on the advice and opinions from some of the world's most innovative educators. Available now for pre-order from Amazon and out on July 7th, 2022.
Yeah, and honestly, it's the one job where you really want to solve everything yourself, because it feels personal. Like, it's your year group, it's your kids, it's your standards, your expectations, it's your world, and you want to do everything yourself. And especially, I think, in the first couple of years of when you're in that role, it does feel a little bit like you're meant to be able to solve everything yourself. And in no other job would we ever expect that, in school and out of school. You know, we wouldn't say to a nurse, fix that patient on your own. You know, there's the implicit understanding in professions that it's a team approach. And dealing with individual students, you have to work as part of a team, and that might be with your tutor team, it might be with your pastoral support teams, it might be with other heads of year. It's also about sort of delegating upwards a little bit as well, and bringing your senior team in to support you when you've reached that point where you're going, right, I don't know what else to do here, I need somebody else, I need somebody to think this through with me, I need somebody to bounce ideas off. That's a really important part that you can get so lost in pastoral care, because you literally just do your own thing all day. And it can start to feel a little bit like, oh, well, if I talk to somebody about it, is it weakness? Does it look like I don't know what I'm doing? And it's the opposite, because you've recognised that things aren't straightforward and that you do need to work with other people to try and get the best thing for kids. There's no way, like if you think about some heads of year, they've got like 450 kids to look after. There is no way on this earth that one person can manage all of that effectively. And so you have to bring in the support to make sure you're getting it right. And again, it's that thing of thinking back to, am I getting the best out of this opportunity for this child? Dealing with things on your own is unlikely to be doing that.
Mm. And I mean, you said it earlier on when we were talking about behaviour. So, you know, some of the best superhero pastoral leaders have been a product of a school that's lacked any kind of systems whatsoever. And they are literally the only person that can solve those problems. And if they're in school, everything is okay with year eight. If they're not in school, you know, God help us, because we've no system to fall back on. And this is, again, back to what you were saying earlier on, that having those clear systems, and you've talked about, you know, if you're not in a school with those kind of systems, then, you know, find another job, which is great advice again.
But, yeah, sorry. Sometimes, you know, I'm a bit blunt occasionally in the book.
But this is right, isn't it? This is absolutely right. And in terms of those systems, it makes it easier then for you as the pastoral leader to delegate to your form teachers. And it was absolutely my pride and joy to be a form tutor when in the first few years of teaching. I loved being a form tutor and I took full responsibility, or I like to think I did, for the progress or the behaviour of those students. So if you've got a system you can exist within, it's easier for you to delegate to form tutors. If you've got a system in which you can work, it's easier for you to go to SLT and ask for support within that system, because they'll have access perhaps to different strategies and different ways of working than you can, you know, in terms of multi-agency or whatever it might be. So I think it's really important that, you know, if you've got a good system, you can delegate that, because being a superhero is really, really tough. And actually, you know, again, are you doing the students and the staff a favour in the long term if you're solving all problems?
Yeah, and ultimately you aren't. And I think you run the risk, in all honesty, of burnout, because it is such a demanding job that is never ending. That if you do try and do it all yourself, ultimately it's not going to end well for you. You're going to burn out. You've got to work more collegiately than that.
And like I said, you know, form teachers or you know they actually do enjoy that job. And given that system and that responsibility, quite a lot of them take, you know, I can think of brilliant examples that we've got of form teachers who take full responsibility for everything that goes on with those students. And that really helps you, doesn't it, as a pastoral lead? And it stops that thing, Amy, when you're on the corridor and you step foot out your door and you think, right, am I going to be able to get to the canteen or to the toilet without being stopped four times before I get anywhere near and just hear, Mr. Naylor, Mr. Naylor, Mr. Naylor, can I just, Mr. Naylor? Yeah, you might be able to just get through that if you've got that ability to delegate and use, you know, all the resources that you've got available to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Naylor's Natter, just talking to teachers.
Right, so last couple of questions then, Amy, if we can. So you've talked really, you know, importantly about, you know, how can pastoral leaders survive and thrive, particularly in 2022. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's like we've just sort of said previously, it's a really, really demanding role. And it's a role that if you're not careful can be really overwhelming. And some days it will feel like it's a challenge to survive, let alone thrive. And it's a little bit like what you've just said there with, like, you try and get to the toilet and you can't because 20 people want to tell you something that's happened so that you can deal with their problem for them. Mm-hmm. It's like, right, how do I do that and do this job? I think my initial years in pastoral care, I didn't really know how to manage things, like, in a way that helped me to free up all of the available time that I had. So I'm an English teacher as well as the various different roles that I've had in school. And that comes with, like, huge marking challenges, for example, and planning and accountability and pressure. And so balancing the two can be really, really hard. And what I had to learn quite quickly was how you work in ways that help you to do your classroom role really well if you're a teaching head of year, whilst also freeing up as much time as you can to do your pastoral role. Because essentially, you can only really do your job to a certain extent when the kids are in the building. So you've got to prioritise that time during the day for work with kids, and think about how you move things elsewhere. So a lot for me, the key for me, I think probably when it clicked in my head, it was about front loading as much as I can with like pre-prepared stuff. So stuff that can be done in advance, do that in advance. Mm. You know, I'll sit and set 5 homeworks for the next 5 weeks in advance, because it takes me 10 minutes one day and it's looked after for the next 5 weeks. So I'm not spending every week like flapping around going, oh, I've not set this, I've not done that. All the things that can be done in advance, do it in advance. All the things that can be pre-planned or pre-prepared, do that in advance. And then it's about like managing your day. Like I really wish when I started that somebody told me how to get through the day, because you will have days ahead of you where you're just like, what is this day? Like, I don't know how to do this. And just once you learn how to do it, you actually, when you get to one of those days, you actually really enjoy it, because you've got the challenge of surviving. You're like, yep, go on, world, throw this at me, because watch me get through to 3:30 in one piece. I will do this, and I will do it brilliantly. But for the first couple of years, you don't necessarily know how to do that. And this is kind of what I was trying to do with that part of the book, was to go, here's what I learned over the time of not doing it very effectively through to doing it slightly more effectively. And just that, really, to try and, you know, especially if you're new to the job, it will always take some time. But the idea of the book is that it takes you less time than it would if you were starting from scratch without it.
Definitely. And in terms of the day there, Amy, so I don't know if it's your emails that are pinging or my emails that are pinging, but it's just very interesting. Isn't that, you know, just to timestamp this, listener, so we are at Czech's Watch, 8 o'clock on a Monday evening, and the life of the pastoral leader clearly has not finished here yet, the number of emails that Amy's received during this. But, I mean, I'm glad you finished it on a positive about that, because the reason that we do this job is that we'd love that, you know, all of us that have been involved in pastoral care do not hang around for as many years as we have, because we find it, you know, really difficult, and it's, you know, and I'm joking about, you know, being shouted at on corridors constantly. You know, the difference you can make is tangible. You know, the influence you can have on students is massive. You know, if you're the head of a year, you know, you're seeing those kids come through school, you can guarantee that when you walk into the classroom, next time you teach them, if you've been head of year 7 and they're in year 11, they'll remember. Yeah. They will come back to you. You know, you can guarantee that behaviours and standards are going to be pretty high in your classes all the way through, just by the fact that, you know, you remember them on the first day when they came into school and they've forgotten the PE kit or whatever it is. It's a joy of a job. It's the best job in the school. And I think that you do reflect that as well within the book and talk about, you know, that it really is one of the best jobs you can have. And also now there's a career path through it, which there wasn't always. You know, yeah. There's potential to do work throughout school, across schools as part of, you know, multi-academy trust. There's CPD opportunities. There's the MPQs, aren't there, in, you know, behaviour now and culture. You know, yes. There's a lot of professional learning that can take place. So it really is a kind of boom time for pastoral leadership, isn't it?
It is.
Someone should write a book on it, Amy, shouldn't they?
Yeah, well, if only someone had thought of that. but yeah, it is. You're right. Like, and I think the new MPQ was a particularly formative moment, actually, because it was like someone with some authority somewhere went, actually, this kind of stuff's really important. Mm. And I'm doing that MPQ purely because I was having a conversation with our with Rachel, who you'll know, Phil. Mm. And I was like, oh, what do I like, I want to do this. And she was like, you know, is it right for you? You know, are you too experienced? Blah, blah, blah. And I was like, no, because nobody, I don't know about any other schools, but there aren't that many opportunities for pastoral leadership development. There aren't opportunities to learn more stuff about this job. There's just lots of other stuff. And so I was like, no, I want to do that because I want to know I'm at the top of my game. I want to be the best leader of behaviour, culture, pastoral care, you know, whatever weird amalgamations jobs become. And know that it's that I've got the best like footing for that. And it, you know, it's a really promising qualification.
It is. And I mean, I'm lucky to be leading on the Teach First version.
That's the one I'm doing.
Is it right? Yeah. And it's brilliant. But then again, you know, we feel as facilitators, we're learning from actually doing that, because the amount of prep that we're going through and the way that Teach First have prepared it all, you know, I feel as if it's sharpening up what kind of things that I'm doing as well. So I would recommend that qualification to anybody, definitely.
Yeah, So whether you're you're an existing pastoral leader or you're just somebody who would like to get into it in the future, it's a really, really good, like, basic set of knowledge that you need to do the job.
It is. Right, Amy, just to finish off, so we just remind listeners that the book is The Complete Guide to Pastoral Leadership.
It is.
A compendium of essential knowledge, research and experience for all pastoral leaders in school. Right, just tell us a little bit about when it's out, Amy, where you're speaking at, other things in terms of social media, launch parties, whatever else you've got planned to share the book with people.
So it's available for pre-order now.
And it's top of the charts, isn't it, as well? Top of the charts.
Top of the charts, it has been. For one brief part of one day.
Doesn't matter.
It's like the 700th most sold book in the UK. And I was like, that's actually quite cool, because 700's not that many more off one, even though it's quite a lot.
Listen, that is brilliant. That is absolutely brilliant. To be that already shows the demand for it.
Prosperity. You can pre-order it. Its publication date is looking like the 14th of March, although it's now all, I've heard back from John Capp today, and they're all back from the printers now.
Wow.
So they should be out pretty imminently, really. And then in terms of other things, I'm speaking at Research Ed, some of the ones that are coming up, I don't know if they've been confirmed yet. So if you're looking at any other ones as potential, potentially going to those events, I may or may not be there. And then in terms of launch parties and stuff, that's not really my kind of thing, I have to be honest. So I will just be sharing bits of the book and talking about it on social media and talking to people doing the job, which is what I think is really important.
Definitely. Right. Well, thanks again, Amy, for coming on tonight, especially on the first day back of a new half term. Like I said, the book is Complete Guide to Pastoral Leadership. It's going to be out pretty much, well, it will be, because we'll tie this in nicely for when the book comes out. So thanks again. And hopefully I'll see you on the road at one of these Research Ed events, which by the time we put this out might involve Blackpool. But I better not say too much. All right. Thanks, Amy.
All right. See ya.
Miller's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Miller's Netter, just talking to teachers.